Hey everyone, it is April 5th, 2017, and this is your episode 91 of At Percussion. With me, as always, are my partners Laura Black.
Hi.
And Megan Arnes.
Hello.
Ben Charles, how's New York there, buddy?
It's going well. I met with Kate and I rehearsed with Gordon yesterday, and he liked what we were doing his piece, so that's cool.
Is it a new Gordon piece?
Yeah, it's a new duo for two marimbas called Bassicata.
Cool.
Yeah, okay, good. Yeah, I see he has lots of hair now, huh?
Yeah. He was like, hey, this is probably the longest you've ever seen my hair.
My ponytail long?
It's always a thing. You play for a composer and they just spend the whole time talking about their hair. It's typical.
No, that was just Mark Applebaum.
I don't
but
know
is
if
it
you
like
talk...
ponytail long, Ben, or what?
Oh, it's like shoulder length, yeah.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
Looks like my dad's hair, actually.
Your dad has great Einstein hair.
It's kind of Einstein-y hair, yeah. Yeah, it looked a lot like that. Yeah. You guys, our guest today is the principal percussionist of the St. Louis Symphony Orchestra. He won that job when he was 25 years old while percussionist in the New World Symphony Orchestra. He's a guest lecturer at the University of Missouri there with Megan, and he's the author of The Modern Concert Snare Drum Roll. And he just literally days ago, while we're recording this, released this really awesome instructional video series on the symphonic percussion audition literature titled The Repertoire. And he was so nice to give us passcodes to check it out. And I've been checking it out, and I just have to say it's really, really cool. And it's so nice to have this detailed, comprehensive resource at our fingertips. And it's really, really cool. I look forward to using it a lot longer, and I hope he doesn't delete my passcode once this podcast is over. So,
and not only really cool, but very well produced. Like,
yes.
It's very good.
Yeah.
Very good.
I think we might have had your producer on this podcast at one point.
Yeah, that's true. I think you have.
Okay, well, I definitely have a question then to start with. That's perfect. So, Will James, how's it going?
It's great. This is a perfect way to end my day. We were all, before we started recording, lamenting our long days, so this is a nice way to end it.
Yeah, beautiful, beautiful. Well, okay, Megan, will you fill me in then? Who is the producer of the Repertoire video
John
series?
Parker.
Oh, okay, that's right. No, I knew that. I saw that on there. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, Mr. Parks really helped me out with, Dr. Parks. I certainly don't want to offend John, but yeah, he's sort of like goes with through it with a fine tooth comb and stitches the quilt together. We've developed quite a good relationship working on this, and I sort of put the pieces together and then he stitches it together, and he's really the reason it looks the way it does.
Oh yeah, well he's been doing great. We've had several of his folks that he's recorded on. I guess the one we probably featured the most there was Tom Bird. And yeah, agree. Just everything about that whole production was working. Tom's new mallets and all John's recordings and everything about it was just really, really good.
Can you tell us about the process of working with him? Like how much was on site and how much of it was done from a distance since you obviously don't live in the same city?
Yeah, well, let me sort of start from the beginning and I'll try to be somewhat brief. I mean, The idea was, you know, I'm sure when you were students, you had colleagues that had, you know, excerpt CDs. Like, I know there are a bunch of horn excerpt CDs and violin excerpt CDs where, you know, really awesome players were playing these excerpts that you were commonly asked in auditions. And I always thought as a student, like, it's a shame that we don't have that. I mean, I know why. It's because our repertoire is just so huge that why would anyone try to record all of that? And I was talking to Scott Herring once when I was on a visit doing a clinic down at USC, and I had known John Parks, but we started like basically called him and was like, hey, like how cool would it be to do, you know, a series? And that's sort of where the idea got birthed. And John and I kept in touch and we talked a lot about how it could work, and especially now how video is relatively easy to capture. I wouldn't say easy, but that video is relatively easy to capture. And so I got in touch with the symphony's audio engineer who records all of our concerts. He's an engineer on all of our CDs, and talked to him. And basically, his name's Paul Henrich. He's local. He does all the audio. And then John does all of the video production with the help of one of our stagehands, Ron Bolte. And we basically come together on stage at Symphony Hall, at Powell Symphony Hall, and you know, we have a recording session, and we basically you know, record the stuff, and then all the content comes to me. I sort of choose takes, and then I send it to Parks, and he sort of cleans it up. So that's sort of the short version of how we do it.
Yeah, amazing. It seems like that stuff happens. I mean, it's incredible that you can do that from afar today.
Yeah, I mean, the files are gigantic. So it's actually easier to mail a hard drive to John than it is to send it over Dropbox. Because you're talking video like, you know, 80-100 gigs. Mm-hmm. And it's just so much easier to send via mail. I mean, if it's a small file, you know, maybe 3, 4, 5 gigs, we'll just send it to each other over Dropbox. But it would take like 5 days to download everything through Dropbox.
Wow.
I think.
Wow.
I love that. That's too funny. This like high tech thing. It's like, no, we just mail it back and forth.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
and I keep a copy. I keep a copy. We're not...
That's good.
Not taking any chances.
That could sound really funny out of context. Like, yeah, John Parks is great, but it's the weirdest thing. You got to mail him your files.
Right.
That's
and
awesome.
It's a P.O. box. He doesn't want us to know where he lives.
Right. Yeah, like it's all like digital and online, but he wants it by mail. It's weird. That's really cool.
That's awesome.
Well, hey, Laurel, I think there's a few more portions of Micah's question there, right? Can you tag some of that onto this?
Yeah, so a Facebook question from Micah Detweiler, one of our friends here on At Percussion. Sticking with the repertoire project, he says, why are you doing it now and why those particular excerpts? And he wants to know any fun facts about the process of this project.
So why now? And in a really bizarre way, this is actually easier to do now because it's not like a concert or a recital where there's a day that, you know, everything has to be ready on a specific day. So I can sort of do it in my own time. You know, there's no deadline. And I have a family now. I have a daughter. We're about to have a son this summer. And you know, that's obviously your first priority for me. So it actually allows me to sort of do it on my own schedule. I did recitals and solo playing and chamber playing before I had a family. And I can't even imagine doing that now. I mean, you know, having to have a big piece ready on a certain day. I mean, I'd have to start like 3 months before just to feel good about it. So even though this project's really huge, you know, if I have two hours in the afternoon, I can, you know, edit. And really the only day that is sort of a drop dead day is the day we record. To answer his questions about why the repertoire has been chosen in the way it has been, is I've sort of been recording the rep that we've been playing in the orchestra. So when we, like, for instance, last year we played John Williams' Escapades, which has like a giant vibraphone part.
I'm learning right now because I have to play that in a few weeks.
Yeah, it's the third. It's a lot easier to play than to record. a drop note in a performance, you know, doesn't really kill anything, but in a recording, obviously it does. But so anyway, like 2 weeks later, I just, you know, reserved the hall and we recorded it. So, but to answer his question about how I chose the actual repertoire, I created like a master list And that was of basically any excerpt that was asked on any audition in the last 2 decades. And that was sort of ridiculous because there are a lot of excerpts that were only asked once, maybe twice. So what I did is anything that was asked twice or more, I sort of put that into a master list. And that was my goal, to record all of that stuff, you know, sort of with the idea of if it takes me 3 or 4 years, that's fine. But, you know, hopefully, you know, in the next couple of years, I'll be done.
Yeah. Well, and I, you know, I'm looking at your website right now and there's a nice link to the repertoire project, and it looks like you've got so much for snare drum up right now. What's the next instrument that you've been working on?
Well, I'm not sure I want to say what the next volume is, because most of it is in the can, but we still have to do some editing and I still have to shoot the actual tutorials. But the hope is that next volume is out certainly before summer festival auditions next year, you know, sort of early winter time.
So here's a question for everybody, and I mean it in the most general possible way. When should we as teachers introduce orchestral excerpts to our undergraduates? And I know there's a lot of caveats to that question, and there's a lot of, well, it depends on where they're at, it depends on what they want to do, it depends on what they've already done. But if you could just speak super, super generally, I'd love to get everyone's just general feel for that.
I'm very curious.
Megan's answer is easy. She's going to say, oh, whenever Will says, because he works for me.
Yeah, that's right. No, I mean, I personally think it should be from the very beginning, and you know, if they're whenever they're starting to study, well, maybe not the very, very, very beginning, but in college, for example, in the Rainer Carroll book, excerpts are included from the very first like unit or lesson, and I like that because then it makes it applicable right away, you know. So I kind of think, you know, not throwing a ton at them, but also I assume that for large ensemble auditions, a lot of schools will use excerpts for their large ensemble auditions. And something I talked to Will about this when we were looking at getting him here on board at University of Missouri was I'm tired of hearing bad large ensemble auditions because I don't have time to incorporate that as much as I would like to in the curriculum, and where those fall in the semester, it's before school starts or it's right after winter break. And even though you can touch them in studio class and you can try to incorporate them some into the curriculum, I just felt like I wasn't able to focus on it as much. So having that as kind of a separate thing, but very planned into the curriculum this way, I think has improved a lot of aspects of their playing, not just in orchestral excerpts.
I think for me, one interesting point to make is that, and I feel weird saying this out loud, but like, I don't want to say most, but many excerpts aren't very difficult on paper, if that makes sense. Like, I think there are Sarone etudes that are much harder than Scheherazade. But I think the point of excerpts is to play them absolutely perfectly. So I have trouble like starting freshmen on excerpts when they just can't execute them perfectly 100% of the time. So I would go sort of echoing Megan's answer, like as early as possible, but at the same rate, maybe picking like the absolute easiest excerpts to start with. And like, I mean, I think Bartok Concerto for Orchestra Snare Drum is a great example of, it doesn't really have anything to do with playing the snare drum in a traditional sense. It's more about making sure it's absolutely perfect and in character. So I don't know. There's no great answer. Like you said, I mean, there's a lot of factors at play, but certainly not throwing too many excerpts at them right from the beginning, I think.
Yeah, it's been incredibly encouraging because I've always thought, oh, they're such a big deal. They're so specific. And I was introduced to them very late in my
studies. I would say I was a late comer.
Very late. As well.
Very late. But, you know, we played Lucanic Kiji here, and you know, so I, oh, okay, my student Steven has the snare drum part. Like, oh, okay, okay, I got to make sure, you know, this is like such a big deal. And Steven's a really good snare drummer. I mean, he has really, really good hands. And he brought it to his lesson, and I said, okay, so the deal is, and I told him the kind of the traditional stuff, but that's really all I said. I didn't say, oh, this is a big, big excerpt in the audition, and this is such a big deal, and you got to buy a, get a special snare drum that plays soft, and I did not make it a big deal. He never played it poorly. I mean, he played it really, really well all the time. And I, yeah, so much of it was just, I don't know, demystifying and you know, making it not scary. And I was so encouraged, you know?
Yeah. So, yeah. Like this afternoon, Casey, you and I were watching some of Will's videos and we got to peak Dom, and Casey has heard me talk before about a teacher I had for only a short time, just a year in undergrad. And my first semester, like 5 weeks in, we started doing snare drum excerpts. And the first one was peak Dom. And and I was just like, what? Like, even as a freshman, it was just too hard for me. I didn't have the hands, and it's one of the choppiest ones of all of them. And like, no wonder I didn't take that path, you know?
Yeah.
So I do think there is a wrong way to do it. And I think for me, that was the wrong way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Will, I'd love to hear your answer to this. I assume it's probably right up there with what Megan said and we all seem to agree with.
Yeah, it's really interesting to hear all of your thoughts. I sort of agree with all the points made. I mean, I think certainly starting a student out in sort of a well thought out, wise way is fruitful. But I think, you know, also really showing the student why an excerpt is different from an etude, because I know the first time I was given an excerpt, I approached it just like an etude. You know, if you just throw, say, Colas Brignon in front of someone, which is the first excerpt I ever learned, you look at it and you're like, this is the easiest thing I've ever played. I mean, I play all these four mallet marimba stuff and, you know, and it's just, you look at it and it's like, well, this isn't hard. It's just eighth notes. But what I think makes excerpts is you have to like show that it's a part of a bigger piece of music. Like, you can't make a lot of the decisions yourself. And the biggest mistake that I hear in auditions, whether it's for percussion or other instruments, I sit on a lot of committees here and I've hired, you know, helped hire a lot of people, is someone plays and in your head you're thinking like, have they even listened to this piece? Like, they don't even know how it goes. I mean, I remember listening to a cello audition, and I mean, I don't even play Beethoven because there's no percussion in Beethoven. I mean, I know that, but I don't really know Beethoven very well. And I'm like, this person, like, I know more about Beethoven than this cellist. I mean, there's such great, you know, repertoire for cello and Beethoven, and they don't know anything about it. So I think, you know, that's the biggest challenge. And I think it's really important to show the students, like, this is why this is hard. Because if you just give it to them and don't really show them that, you know, this is why, this is the challenge of this, then they're just going to look at it like an etude, and it's not going to really sound like the bigger piece.
So I had a question that could maybe answer this question very well, because Will, you won the New World audition very young, which obviously most people are winning New World very young, but then you went on to win St. Louis very young as well. What was your experience with excerpts in your upbringing?
Yeah, well, like I said, I mean, Colas was my first excerpt, and I had to prepare it for my ensemble audition at Northwestern. And, I mean, that's exactly what I did. I got it. I practiced it on marimba. I didn't practice it on xylophone because I didn't own a xylophone. And after, like, 20 minutes, I was like, okay, like, I've got it.
Done.
And I'll let you guess how awesome my audition went when I got to Northwestern. needless to say, it went pretty poorly. But, you know, after studying with Mike and Jim at Northwestern, you know, they really showed me what it's all about. And I managed to somehow get into Civic when I was a junior at Northwestern. And that's when I sort of really turned a corner of like, okay, like this is really what I want to do. I really enjoy and I still enjoy playing solo and chamber stuff. But like the idea of playing with 90 other people, you know, creating this work of art really got me going. So that's when I sort of really decided to go down that path and get really serious about it. And basically grad school was, all right, like let's learn everything, you know. You know, really, it's a topic we could get into later, but I didn't take auditions in grad until very late because I was like, why am I going to take an audition if I know I'm not ready? So it was like, let's learn the rep. Let's get like really ready. And then we'll take auditions.
Yeah. Great. Great. Do you think it's possible, Will, to overhype the excerpts? I've seen, and I think back to my student with the Kiji story, and he was very new to that excerpt, but he never approached the drum with shaky hands. He never did all the things that I've seen so many people who are studying excerpts regularly. I just never saw him do any of the things that they do with that horrible, awful first drag, you know? And right. It just makes me think, is there something to just like toning down, like how, I don't know, how militant we need to be about so many of the, I don't know, I'm not sure how to say this, but is that, maybe that's helpful, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think you can overthink it, certainly. You know, I'll use an example. I mean, a lot of people go to an audition and get cut. And they come home and they are like, okay, I got cut, so I have to rethink everything. And right. 90%, even 95% of what you were playing could have been awesome. But, you know, maybe 4 or 5% needs to change. So I'm not saying that, you know, everybody shouldn't, you know, examine their own playing. But sometimes things are fine. It's something else. And that can be really frustrating, especially when you get cut from an audition, because you know a lot of what you were doing could have been really great, but right. You know, there were some weaknesses. But I, you know, I would go back to sort of the basic stuff of, you know, are you consistent? You know, is your time solid? You know, are you stylistically representing the piece? And you know, anytime I find myself getting stuck, like I'm just beating my head against a wall and I don't know if I'm improving, I record myself. And, you know, I'll either listen back to it a day later, or I'll send it to somebody, or I'll go play for somebody. Mm-hmm. You know, recording myself is huge. And sometimes when I feel lost, I'll put some distance between me and the recording so I won't really remember what I did. Mm-hmm. And so I'm like listening to it with fresh ears, and that typically helps.
Great.
I have a follow-up question. It's interesting for me to hear that you say you put off, or I don't want to say put off, but you didn't audition until you felt like you were really ready to audition, didn't use auditions as an experiment. But then you also won these auditions very young. So how many auditions did you take before you won New World in St. Louis, and what were you doing to prepare, you know, going out of one audition? What was your takeaway going into the next?
Yeah, well, I think it's a mental thing. You know, any type of competition, whether it's sports or, you know, solo competition or anything, you know, I think there's a huge mental side. And I saw a lot of my friends who would fly to an audition. And I mean, they knew they weren't ready, and I knew they weren't ready. And it was sort of like, why, you know, and they would, and it's the same thing. They would all say, like, I'm doing it for experience. And I mean, I understand that, you know, we all need experience. You know, you can't just, you know, jump right in. And, but I see mock auditions, summer festival auditions, you know, all of that is how you get your experience. I really think the game changes mentally when you know, like, you're competitive. Like, you have a chance because, you know, that first time you advance to the semifinal round, you know, all of a sudden the nerves get, like, even more heightened. Like, whoa, like, I may have a chance here. And if you go into it already with the mindset of, yeah, I know, like, that's the whole point of why I'm here, you know, you have a better chance of success. I mean, if you, you know, if you sort of sneak through into the semifinal round, and in the back of your brain, you're like, oh, I hope they don't ask this excerpt. I'm not really ready. Like, I mean, you're just setting yourself up for failure. And, you know, if you take 20 auditions before you're really ready to compete, that's 20 failures, like, weighing on the back of your head. And I'm not saying you can't get over that. But, you know, I just took the attitude of, you know, I have really good teachers and I'm surrounded by really good people. And when they tell me, hey, like, you really could be competitive, you know, that's when I really started taking auditions. You know, I mean, don't get me wrong. I mean, I was taking mock auditions. I was auditioning for summer festivals. I was playing, you know, lots of mock auditions and that sort of environment. But, you know, when your career is on the line, it's just a different, it's a different thing.
Yeah, great. Yeah, thanks, Will. Great words. Hey, Megan, what do you have to share with us today?
Well, I have a current event to share that's happening right now as we speak on April 5th. And this is something I came across on the New Music USA website. There's a project page called the Mega Organ, the Interactive Improvisation Space, and subtitled A Sonic and Kinetic Installation and Improvisation Environment of Harmonica Playing Inflatable Sculptures. I saw this title and I was like, whoa, what is that? That sounds crazy. So I looked into it a little bit more, and here's what it sounds like. And what you'd see if you were in this installation is something that looks like a lot of inflatable structures, like air mattresses, sort of. It's really bizarre.
All I can think of is, like, the Family Guy, like, wacky, wavy, fully inflatable.
Oh, thing. Yeah.
yes, I know. Yeah, so this mega organ is a piece of installation art, and it's an environment for improvisation. And it's been open through all of March. It was funded by New Music USA. And it's in the loft of the Judson Memorial Church in Greenwich Village in New York. And this organ does not function anymore. So this mega organ kind of resonifies the organ using these inflatable structures that are built from flexible plastic and then joined with organ pipes with the organ pipes and walls. So the sculptures, the inflatable sculptures, have lots of harmonicas and other free reeds that are fixed into their air escape points. So when they're inflating or deflating, they're making organ-like sounds. So to add to that, there are high-powered fans in the installation that animate the sculptures and excite the reeds and create all these drone sounds that you just heard. And the fans are controlled actually by a combination of motion sensors and physical switches that are reacted when viewers and listeners enter the space. So it's really bizarre thing. And this installation is open in specific days throughout March. And tonight it's actually the closing night, and they have a concert happening from 8 to 10 p.m. So again, right now. And there are several improvisers, famous improvisers, such as Ingrid Lobrock on saxophone, Peter Evans on trumpet, Amirtha Kadambi, a voice, I don't know if I'm saying her name right, and Travis LaPlante on saxophone, that are playing the mega organ in this concert series. There are also several musicians who are kind of like artists in this installation, and they are recording an album based on their experience inside the installation. So I just wanted to read you the opening paragraph of their project proposal. Imagine what it would sound like to be surrounded by 70 gigantic-mouthed harmonica players who could each play 10 notes at once without ever needing to breathe. This is the core sonic image that grew into a series of interactive harmonica-playing inflatable sculpture installations. First Harmonibots, and now Mega Organ. So when you, if you go to this website, you can not only experience that sound world again, but you can see people kind of jumping on the sculptures. It reminds me kind of a bounce house or something, and people interacting with them. The collaborators of on this project that were creating the album are improviser Sam Pluta on electronics, again, Peter Evans, Marantha Kidambi, Travis LaPlante, and Ingrid Laubrock. So adding Sam Pluta to the electronics. So an album will be created from this installation. It's located at, like I said, at the Judson Memorial Church Loft on 55 Washington Square South in New York. So crazy sound installation. Have any of you ever experienced something like this? Oh, and sorry, let me interject real quick. The creator, of course, of this, her name is Sky McClay.
Yeah,
a composer, oboist, and installation artist. So, Casey, do you know?
No, not really. Okay. Only, it's funny you mentioned her because a colleague of mine had happened to show me the string quartet of hers called Many, Many Cadences, which is actually linked on this site. When you click on her name, it'll have a YouTube video of this string quartet called Many, Many Cadences, and it's really interesting.
Spectral Quartet recorded that, right?
Yeah, that's right. You guys just have to check that out. You'll laugh and also really dig it at the same time. It's just like perfect authentic cadence after perfect authentic cadence, but it's constantly modulating. Mm-hmm. So, or I think it's something like that. Maybe they're not all perfect, but it's cadence after cadence after cadence, but it's constantly changing keys, and the rhythms are really, you know, out there, and the effect is really interesting.
Huh. The thing I was thinking of the whole time that I was going to ask, and you sort of answered my question. I was going to ask if Brian Eno was involved in this at all. Is anyone familiar with Brian Eno?
Yeah, a little bit familiar.
He's a record producer, and he's produced some big names. I wish I could pull one off the top of my head. But he also has made his own music, and he has a series of four albums called Music for Airports. And the very first one is, it's just a bunch of tape loops that are out of sync. And his whole idea was that airports are such a chaotic environment, you don't need music to actually listen to in airports. You need some sort of ambient, just calming noise to take the chaos out of the airport. So every single time I'm in an airport or I'm flying, I always listen to Brian Eno, Music for Airports. Mm-hmm. Actually, I think just the first of the series, I think it's called Ambient 1, 2, 3, and 4. And Ambient 1 is Music for Airports. But then I was excited when I first got an iPhone because Brian Eno actually created a few iPhone apps that were supposed to replicate that. But obviously, if you make a recording, you can't have a truly different lengths of tape loop because it's a recording. It's going to play the same every time. So he had some iPhone apps. One was called Bloom that sort of simulated this in a non-recorded sense. You could create your own little Music for Airports things. But yeah, that was that's one of my favorite sort of ambient noise things.
That's cool. Well, I love about also just the location of this project is that they specifically identified like a high traffic space, and this church often houses different dance, theater, and art things. events, and it's also a hub for human services and social justice outreach. So they're kind of, you know, not on purpose, reaching lots of different people outside of the typical New Music audience. So I love that.
It sounds like they've taken a defunct instrument that would just be sitting there collecting dust, doing nothing, and actually recaptured it to make it into something usable.
Yeah, exactly. I love that too. Also, I love the fact that the vibe of this church is such that doors open at 7, free dinner at 7:15, music at 8.
Wow, that's great. Thanks, Megan. Nice job.
Yeah.
Laurel, do you have anything for Will on Facebook there?
Yeah, I do. So this is part two of Micah Detweiler's question. He says, I love the modern concert snare drum roll. I use the concept to teach my middle school students how rolls differ from normal strokes from day one. What inspired you to get so nerdy about the roll?
Well, it was not intentional. I have my own students, and I was basically finding myself writing down exercises for them, and I would use pieces of other books. And after a year or two, I just sort of realized, you know, I've kind of got the beginnings of, like, at least a notebook or something. So I started writing it down and, you know, how it would be organized. And it's basically just sort of how I teach the roll. And, you know, I got a lot of great advice once I knew that I was going to write a book from other people that had written books as far as how to format it and, you know, how to structure it from beginning to end. So, yeah, I mean, it really just sort of came about through my own teaching and my own notes. And I'm sure old students have, like, handwritten copies of basically exactly the same thing. But, yeah, that's how it came about.
Cool. Is it, you know, Micah says he uses it for his middle school students from day one. Is that the aimed demographic, or is it really for anybody, or are there parts of the book for different ages?
I mean, it's definitely, you know, anybody could use it. I mean, the beginning is certainly aimed towards a beginner, you know, someone who basically knows how to hold the sticks and how to play basic rhythms. But there are definitely some exercises in the back that borderline, you know, Casey Cangelosi, like evil genius, you know, wrist twisters. And that's sort of why I structured the book the way I did is, you know, here's how to build a roll. And then the last sort of 25% of the book is like, here's how to maintain it. Here's some, you know, really difficult exercises to work on, you know, your loud roll, your soft roll, and everything in between.
Well, you guys, we just talked about a little art installation in New York, and I ran into yet another facet to the discussion of arts funding and cuts. And I was in my car listening to NPR, and of course, you know, everything I think on the podcast side and the university music program side of things and the symphony concert hall side of things agrees, well, this is good funding and we want these things and we think this funding is really important and we don't want to see groups like the NEA cut. So I happened to hear this little interview on NPR with I believe he is a theater director from New York City, and he says he is a conservative and he doesn't think the NEA should be funded the way that it is, and he agrees with the cuts. So I thought it's actually really, really short. You can find it on npr.org. And the title is, As Trump Mulls Funding Cuts for the Arts, An Artist Argues Against the NEA. So I thought it was really interesting, and I wanted to examine what the guy said. So his name is David Marcus, and the interviewer named Scott Simon says, you're an artist. What's wrong with the government supporting the arts? And Marcus's response is, Well, the basic problem with the government supporting the arts in the way that it does through the NEA and through direct grants to producing organizations, that is that it stands in the way of free market competition, which is really the best way for arts organizations to build new audiences. These arts organizations are less incentivized towards going out and getting new audiences than they are to going out and getting new grants. So I think that if we remove some of that grant, incentive and force these arts organizations to compete in a free marketplace, we'd see a more vibrant arts community that was bringing in more diverse audiences and just larger audiences in general. So there's not a lot more, but I thought I've heard that argument before, and I was just wondering, I really hate everything about it, but I want to hear what you guys think about that point of view.
So just to jump on something really quick, the first thing that comes to mind for me is that a lot of these grants are aimed at getting these things to an audience that would not produce a profit and that would otherwise not have access to it. For example, inner city kids will never hear a symphony unless the symphony or some sort of grant, some sort of organization is bringing the kids into the symphony hall. Will plays in a symphony. He can attest to the fact that inner city 7-year-olds aren't buying concert tickets and never will. So I think that's the very first thing that comes to mind to me, is that it's going to a better cause than, like, they're not paying the conductor a higher salary because they're getting a grant, I don't think.
So I think his logic, and I agree with you, Ben, but I think his logic, I'm trying to play devil's advocate here, is that they would go seek those unique audiences if they had to. If they had to compete, they would, instead of spending so much time trying to get grant money, they would go out and try to get those audiences.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, though, I just think that those audiences are the ones, the most important ones are the ones that won't bring in money.
I love the look on Megan's face just now, and I totally agree with you, Megan. Real quick, I mean, we've heard this argument before about if you privatize stuff, it'll be competitive, and if it's competitive, thus the quality will go up. But I hate that he puts that out there and just kind of says, because I think so. It's like, well, wait a minute, what's the data you have to back that up? I mean, all we have are examples of that not working, frankly. Okay, we have, say, retail stores want to compete. They need to lower their prices so that more people come to their stores. That doesn't mean they're producing better quality products. In fact, it's always the opposite. They're producing cheaper products that break really quickly and are crap, and they thus can lower their prices and be more competitive. I really fear that the symphony's version of doing this is playing more watered down music that maybe we don't want to play, maybe really modifying things to the point where it's going to be more broad appeal, and it's going to be a really big sacrifice to be competitive in that way.
I have a question actually related to this, and Will, hopefully you can answer this. In a symphony, I know, like, I've heard the majority of the symphony's funding doesn't come from ticket sales, and I know a lot of it comes from corporate sponsors. So do you have any idea of what the breakdown is of corporate sponsorships, ticket sales, and government funding?
Private donations, I guess, right?
Yeah. Our model is about a third of our revenue comes from ticket sales, about a third comes from our endowment, and then a third comes from our annual campaign. I mean, we do have some corporate sponsorships, but that sort of fits into the annual campaign.
Would the corporate sponsors be part of the annual campaign?
Yeah. So, like, Wells Fargo sponsors our subscription series, and occasionally we'll have a corporate sponsor for certain events, but there's really not a lot of corporate sponsorships. I mean, it's not like they're looking for that. I mean, with any sort of donation, you know, even, you know, my personal donations or, you know, anything else in that world, There's a whole lot less just giving to give. You know, there's sort of giving and wanting something in return, even if it's small. You know, there's a big thing in St. I mean, we're getting off topic a little bit, but, you know, a big thing in St. Louis is a lot of, they have a lot of trivia nights to, like, raise money for charities. So you're getting, like, this entertainment in a trivia night, but the money's going towards a charity. So it's not like you're just giving money with nothing in return. So on a grander scale, that's sort of the corporate, you know, the corporate corporations want, you know, free advertising, basically.
Yeah, great. Well, let me just give another little sample from this discussion from NPR. Let's see. What about some other programs that NEA funded, like art therapy for veterans, art education for youngsters who might be in inner city schools, public murals in neighborhoods that could stand to see a glimpse of beauty? Marcus responds, I think there's absolutely a place for them. Now, you know, I'm a conservative, so I would prefer to see that stuff done more at a state and local level than a federal level, but I have much less problem with that. Again, the problem is that the government is picking winners and losers. I think that even Paul Ryan in his budget in 2014, you know, he basically said in the proposal, he said, look, this is a wealth transfer from poorer people to wealthier people. You're asking the middle class to fund the entertainment of the wealthy. That's not right. It doesn't matter if you're spending $250 million on that or $25 on that. We shouldn't be doing it.
I don't like the idea that Paul Ryan thinks good art is only for the wealthy. Like, what does that say about him?
Well, yeah, I don't know if that's what he, well, he's saying that, you know, we all pay federal taxes that eventually trickle down after they buy planes and bombs. The little crumbs that are left over go to places like the NEA, and, you know, the tickets at the symphony are very expensive, and like Ben was saying, inner city kids aren't buying those tickets. It's wealthier people that are buying those tickets.
I have a quote that I'll paraphrase that I think can kind of counter that. Have any of you been to the Kennedy Center and seen the quote from John F. Kennedy about the arts? And yeah. I'm paraphrasing here. I'm not going to get the wording exactly right. But John F. Kennedy said something along the lines of, a great society will be remembered not by its government or its wealth, but by its culture. And it's true. Like, if you look at, you know, many ancient cultures like the Greeks, we admire much of their architecture and art and sculpture and these things. So I guess it is sort of a little bit, what's the word I'm looking for? It's a little bit dreamy, I guess, to say that, you know, the United States should fund art to make some sort of grand statement to humanity. But I mean, that's what we were doing with space travel too, trying to achieve something greater than ourselves. So I don't know. I hear what's being said here, but at the same rate, it's like, can't we just strive for something better just because we're human beings?
Hmm. Yeah.
But also, I really have issues with what Ryan is insinuating in his statement. Like, expensive symphony tickets are only one of dozens of different ways that the NEA helps the arts in our country. Like, you can apply as an individual. You can apply with whatever chamber music project you have, which most likely will impact your local community in a really great way. You know, and the NEA supports all these, like, new music organizations or Chamber Music America, which I just applied for a grant to. And so hopefully it will exist in time to be awarded to me if they pick it. Yeah, it's just so many other things that... It's like he just, I feel like the ignorance portrayed in his statement is really quite baffling.
Well, and I think that's the common thing I see. You know, it's a lot of these statements are like logical opinions, but they're just kind of declarations. They're just saying, yeah, like, please, let's have some data. Let's back this up a little bit. Like, here we are, we can name the direct things that the NEA is good for, and we can see that of just how cheap it is compared to the amounts of money out there that we're spending. I mean, it's just so easy to see, you know, look, if we like art, if we value art, This is a very easy, cheap way to support it.
I totally hear what Casey's saying, and you're saying, like, let's see some data to back up, blah, blah, blah. But at the same rate, like, I hate that so much. And doing my undergrad as a music ed major, it always bothered me when they said, well, if you ever need to defend music education in your school, remember, you can say it's good for math scores, and it's good for critical thinking, and it's good for all these other things. And I get it that that's how you have to talk to administrators, but it's like, for God's sake, can we just have music because it's worth having music and culture and art and beauty? Why do we have to back it up by saying it'll make your math SAT scores better? So yeah, I totally hear what you're
saying. I mean, of course.
I mean, it just makes my blood boil hearing it put that way.
Oh, that's good. This is good. I like pissing Ben off. That's just always. If I can just piss Ben off more often, it'd be a good episode.
If the whole world just had my viewpoint, it would be so much easier.
I think you're right. I guess I want to bring it up because I think we as advocates, we have to have more ways of expressing that music is more than just entertainment. And Laurel, you hear me talk about this all the time, every freaking little clinic I ever do or whatever. Art, and especially fine art, it specifically exists to do more than entertain you. And there's so many things that has to teach us about ourselves. And I just think the more ways and the more angles we can approach that topic with, the more people we can reach. So Ben, yeah, of course you're right. But at some point, you know, the dean of some campus of actually probably hundreds of campuses out there. I mean, we know this happens. They look at, say, the private lesson situation and they go, wait a minute, we're paying a teacher 1 hour to teach one student 1 hour. Wait, that just does not make sense financially. And of course, they're looking at the music appreciation course. They're going like, no, this is great. That's an 80-to-1 ratio. There, we're making money. We need to do that more. So, I mean, any tools we can have to explain that to that person, or to explain it another way to this guy who's saying, no, these guys need to compete for tickets because that'll boost the quality or whatever. I mean, because it threatens children's concerts. You know, the Stanton Music Festival here, mm-hmm. I was talking to one of the organizers' wives about this very thing on NPR, and she said she had listened to it, and it bothered her for all the same ways it bothered me. But she told me all the different ways that the NEA supports the Stanton Music Festival. We just did this children's concert, and the thing she kept coming back to was kids. It was, hey, you can, families of this many people, can kids come free to concerts? Mm-hmm. And
I mean, also competition's a bit of a misnomer, because most cities only have one symphony. I mean, St. Louis Symphony isn't competing against St. Louis Symphony number 2.
Well, that's what I mean by it would be great to see some data. You know, these guys are talking and they just kind of say, oh, well, that just makes sense, right? If they competed, they'd have to worry about being better. See? So it's going to get better. And that's it. And then they're done. And that's also why it's a really short interview, is because there's just not much substance there. And it's like, wait, I'm totally interested in hearing these opinions, but I need to, like, it needs to be backed up somehow. I mean, it's as frustrating to me as hearing the president saying, oh, it's just going to be great. It's going to be awesome. Don't worry, it's going to be the best. That just doesn't mean anything. You know, that literally means nothing. It's like, dude, I would totally be open to trusting you. I would totally be open to switching parties. I'd be up for voting for anyone if they would just say, here's the plan, and this is how I'm going to do it, and this is why it's going to work. You just so rarely hear that. It's much more done in this type of conversation I just read, which is, hey, you know, this will kind of work because I just kind of think so. I mean, you know, come on, it makes sense, right? It's like, no, dude, show me some information. And there's another segment on there. They talk about opera specifically, and he goes back to this competition idea and says they need to not put their energy towards getting grants. They need to just get out to new audiences and get to audiences. And again, I just think, man, if you're going to try to base your art on how much of it will sell, you're talking about the decline of a lot of the arts we're trying to advocate and a lot of the arts we're creating and supporting. And yeah, because I mean, guess what? Avant-garde contemporary music isn't often the giant ticket sales, you know? So if ticket sales become so important, then what we have the freedom to perform and program is going to be really limited.
Yeah, I hate that it's, I don't know, that we're trying to put like a price on saying that we're wasting time by writing grants. You wouldn't have to write grants if there was appropriate funding for it in the first place, or if it was something that you could make a lot of money off of, right?
Yeah.
So it's just is a little offensive. Like,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, and writing grants is not that fun.
It's back, and I think it's back to the same, like the university private teaching analogy I made. You could make the same case for tickets. I mean, without the grants and without the donations, if you had to solely run the St. Louis Symphony on ticket sales, I'm sure we could easily do what that calculation of what those ticket sales would have to be. No one would come. You know, you can't do art at that level for that cheap. It's real expensive. You know, you can't do the conservatory model private teaching that we're trying to do at all our universities cheaply. It's expensive. It's a 1-to-1 hour professor to student relationship. If you want to keep doing it at that high level, yeah, it's expensive. And a lot
And also like it's getting to such a high level because lots of people are doing it and technology has allowed people to share ideas more readily. So it doesn't make sense because if it was more competition to even survive in the music world, less people mm-hmm. are going to be musicians, and then it's going to be less competitive, or the mm-hmm. level's going to lower.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah,
I don't know. It's so frustrating too because even looking at this, like this was my thesis in writing about Jordan and funding of orchestras in Jordan, and in surveying the entire Middle East, Jordan was the only country that wasn't supported by the Ministry of Culture, and it didn't work. It folded, you know. It was the only for that time until it was privatized, the only Middle Eastern country without an orchestra because it wasn't funded by the government, or at least aided by the government.
Yeah, sure. I want to restate something I said a few episodes ago. I know plenty of folks on the conservative side of things with like really good viewpoints and a lot of really, really important things to say and a lot of viewpoints that like need to be in the conversation and stay in the air. Man, none of them hate art. Like, and it may just be I don't know those people. And someone maybe said like, "No, Casey, you're in a bubble." even the people on the other side that you know are in your bubble. So maybe that's mm-hmm. true. But I hate to think that it's a like Republican Democrat thing because I don't know Republicans that want art to go away. I don't. I really don't. I don't know a single one. So it's a very confusing thing about our world.
Yeah.
You're very quiet, Will.
No, y'all have opened up an enormous can of worms that I'm not sure a hour-long podcast is gonna solve. Mm-hmm. I mean, I certainly have.
I think we'll solve that. No, I think we can solve this whole thing.
Yeah,
we can't even figure out how to spell histoire. So
that's right.
Yeah.
Hey, let's ask Will James.
No, I'm.
Yeah, do it.
How do you spell Histoire du Soldat, the first word?
The camera freezes.
Is he frozen? We'll never know.
We'll never know. I think he's pretending. I think he's dodging the question. He's pretending to be frozen.
Oh, no.
See, little does he know, he only has to tell us the first letter to answer the question.
Casey broke the internet.
Hey, while he's doing that, let me just since Will's connection broke for a second there, let me read one more little bit from this, and it may not add anything more, but let's try this. So another question, would we really live in a better country, though, if, let's say, opera and ballet were to have to struggle even more than they already do to stay alive? Marcus answers, well, I think that we would. You know, creative destruction is not a bad thing, and I'm not actually convinced that opera and ballet would go away if you took this funding away. I think they might look different. I think you might attend them in theaters that maybe are a little smaller. I think that it would take on a new face. But there's people who want to make this art. They're not going to stop. I mean, government is not necessary to create art. Art is older than government. So I don't think we'd lose opera. I think that it would maybe look different, and that's the nature of art. I mean, some things go away, some things come into existence. That's the beauty of art. We can't simply stay in the same place.
Does this guy have like a rich patron that always helps him put on his plays?
I don't know. I didn't look into to who he is much. And I don't know. I mean, I think he's certainly right. Like, opera would look different if it didn't have a lot of money to support itself, and we might stop hearing the big operas. I think that's a bad thing. I don't think they should go away. I have, of course, no problem with things changing and becoming different. And I agree with them. I mean, Carl, we had that conversation with one of our colleagues where I said, We were talking about the Philadelphia strikes, and I said, man, those salaries are so huge. It's amazing people can get fussy over these salaries and things. You know, just make art. Don't wait for your paycheck. If you love art, make art. I mean, I totally get that opinion, and I feel like I make art all the time. That it's going to get me no money at all, but you just do it to do it.
Historical side note, and actually sort of relating to our little joke here, part of the reason that Stravinsky wrote Histoire was because Europe was basically bankrupt at the time, and it didn't make sense to continue writing these gigantic orchestra works that no one could afford to put on. So he wrote this work as a fundraising tool, basically.
Well, I think some of it is just it can be very confusing to me, because unless this guy is doing like absurdist, surrealist, postmodernist type theater works, like, I mean, I love plays. But it seems like something that can be met a bit more passively than live music and performance, particularly, you know, like a symphony or a ballet or an opera. Like, you have to meet it with at least 5% an active ear and an active mind. Whereas I do think you can sit in a theater and watch a play in your vernacular language just as passively as you could watch a movie at home. You'll have a more powerful experience because you're watching people like feet from you go through something. But I feel like, yeah, the music demands a little more, and that's ultimately what really bothers me. Like, you put everything towards too much competition, or you say that's what matters, and you end up with news networks that have such specific leanings that you can't even tolerate watching one that you don't totally agree with. Or you get these TV stations that go from being about history and about documentaries to being about Honey Boo Boo, because that's what people want to watch, because it's people are overworked and they're stressed out, and then they just want to go home and watch stupid TV. And I love stupid TV. There's a spot in my heart for shows like Small Town Security and Rock of Love with Bret Michaels. Like, there's a spot for shows. That. But I don't confuse that with art made by, like, really, really talented people right in front of my face.
Well, right, and I mean, I love, like, you know, Gold Rush on Discovery Channel, but I don't confuse that with what the Discovery Channel was programming 15 years ago.
Exactly.
Or 20 years ago, you know. Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, evidence has shown, and yeah, great. I said retail, you're saying TV and news. That's absolutely true. We see that totally. They compete and they just get stupider. They get stupider and simpler. Just like the retail stores, they get cheaper and cheaper and cheaper, and the quality goes right down.
So more importantly, though, Will, can you tell us Mr. Stravinsky's chamber work, The Soldier's Tale, the title in French? Can you please spell the first word?
L-E.
Damn it.
We just needed the L. Yeah, there's
but he said L-E, that's incorrect. It'd be L apostrophe, so you're both right.
But he said L.
Yeah, and he also said E, so you're both right.
He said L apostrophe.
Yeah, Ben. I really want to know, you know, we're coming up on our 100th episode, and I'm sure we'll, you know, I wonder if this joke will live on for another 100.
It's so dumb, it has to.
It must feel dumb when you're losing it.
I'm not losing it, though. We've had so many people agree. Didn't Mike Rosen agree with me?
I think you had like one person agree with you who was like drunk or something. No, I don't know.
Wait, we were supposed to be drinking during this podcast?
Yeah. I think, I'm pretty sure. Yeah, I'm quite sure. Well, we'd love to hear. I've been ranting about this funding thing a little bit, but man, you're in there. You're principal of the St. Louis Symphony. I'd love to hear just any little words or thoughts you have about this guy and this NPR thing.
Well, I mean, I didn't know we were going to jump into politics, and I mean, it's like with anything that big, I mean, there's no short answer. There's no easy answer, really. I mean, I'm really lucky to do what I do, and I think I speak for all of us that we're really lucky to get to do what we do. And ticket sales are just not going to cover, you know, our career. And with any sort of organization, you're going to have to rely on outside support to have things like this. And you know, like I said, only a third of our income at the orchestra comes from ticket sales. And I mean, we probably could operate a orchestra on that budget, but you know, 99% of the musicians here, you know, would be looking for employment elsewhere if our budget was only a third of what it is. And so we're really lucky because we have, you know, really committed people in our community who are committed to keeping a high level orchestra. And that's one of the things that I love about St. Louis is it's the perfect balance of a city for me. You know, I can have a decent idea of how long it'll take me to get somewhere. Like, it's not like New York or DC or LA where, you know, what should take 10 minutes takes 2 hours. But it's big enough that we can sort of support cultural institutions that, you know, big cultural institutions. And, you know, the only way that happens is with, you know, people who are wealthy, who have wealth, who are giving back. And, you know, my wife and I, we give back to organizations that we support, but I mean, on a much smaller level, but I think that's really important. And something that, I mean, it's probably not appropriate for us to be instilling that in students, unless they're really close students. But I mean, I think, you know, certainly giving back to organizations that you support, I mean, that is one of the great things about our country is that, you know, we do have that culture here. You know, and I do think that is healthy, actually, that, you know, charitable giving, you know, is really important and something that I think is something we actually do well.
That's a good point.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Laurel, do you have a last Facebook question there for Will, or did we cover everything?
Well, I have
Matt Henry.
Yeah, I have kind of a slew of questions from Matt.
Should we do like rapid fire?
Let's start with the little ones. Why is bourbon so good? It's the most important question.
Oh, yeah. No, words cannot. They're not enough words. No, bourbon is delicious. It is a nice way to end the day. And perhaps after this podcast, I will be sampling one.
Good. Next question. Has weightlifting improved your musical acuity? If so, how?
Weightlifting has been great. It's actually a lot more similar to what we do than you would really think at first glance. You know, if you're lifting something really heavy over your head, you better be pretty focused. And for, you know, it's for something for a very short amount of time. You know, physically, it's really helped my posture. I was in pretty good shape. I was a runner. But when I started weightlifting, like, I was just so much more aware of my body position, and weird times. I remember a few months after I started weightlifting, I bent down to like drink some water out of a water fountain. And I was like consciously thinking about how my, you know, I was bending for my hips and my spine angle. And I was like, I would not have done that, you know, several months ago. And I have a really great trainer. And it's just like, you know, with us, you know, you have a really good teacher, you learn a lot. And I have a really great trainer and just feel like I know the anatomy of the body so much better.
Hmm. What does it feel like to be an integral part of the legacy of the SLSO percussion section?
Yeah, it's really humbling, you know, when you think about it, because, you know, day to day, you don't really think about stuff like that. But, you know, we're the second oldest orchestra in the country. And so there have been a heck of a lot of people that have had this job before me. And, you know, hopefully there'll be a lot of people that have the job after me. So it's a little weighty to sort of think about it in that perspective. I mean, you know, I really try to take the things that have been great about what's about this job before me and continue that, but then also know that at some point I'm going to be passing the reins to somebody else.
Cool. And I know Ben wanted to ask you about your collaboration with Grover. Ben?
Yeah, I guess I could just ask, you know, tell us about your drum. But one thing that I know comes up a lot with products is, and I think you would agree with this, there are already so many great snare drums on the market. So what specifically made you want to go after that project of designing your own, and what is unique about yours?
Well, it's kind of like not a very sexy story, actually. I wanted a drum that was basically like an etude drum, something, you know, that could be really sensitive but also play relatively loud. And so I sent Neil some specs, you know, with regards to bearing edge and thickness and strainer and whatnot, snares. And because, I mean, that's one of the things that they do really well is they can build custom drums really relatively easily. And after it was done, he sort of approached me then and said, hey, do you want to just put your name on it? And, you know, we'll sell it. And so it was sort of like, oh, well, yeah, sure. I mean, the drum that you see me playing on in all the repertoire videos was actually like the first drum. And then we did sort of some aesthetic things to it so that, you know, the idea was that if you saw the drum from 100 feet away, you'd be like, oh, that's Will's drum. So like there's like a gray sparkle on the side, which is kind of cool. But other than that, I mean, the drum's exactly the same as what you see in the videos. And yeah, it was really something I didn't think about or like was like pushing to do. It just sort of came about.
It's a way cool drum.
I like it.
Yeah, thanks, man.
Yeah. Toying with it at the last PASIC was really neat.
Yeah, there's a lot of really cool technology in it. I mean, you know, at this point, I don't think anybody's going to completely reinvent the wheel. I mean, you know, there are a lot of really good drums out there. And, you know, now we're sort of just refining and, you know, okay. I mean, I obviously
we'll see
think
people trying to reinvent the wheel.
Yeah. But, you know, I think it sounds great. And I've been nothing but happy with it. And yeah.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, way to go, Neil Grover. Hey, well, you guys, thanks so much for joining me on episode
91.
Ugh, thank you. Yeah, 91. Thanks so much. I know, it's exciting. Yeah, thanks so much for joining me on 91. And man, check out the repertoire by Will James. If you go to willjamespercussion.com, you can find
it. Williamjamespercussion.com.
Oh, thank you. Yes, that's right. Yeah, if you go there, you can find your way to the repertoire. And yeah, it's just such a nice, comprehensive listing. And it's yeah, it's really great. So, okay, guys, catch you next week. Thanks a lot.
Cool.
Bye.